Okay, with that, we had asked some time ago if Tom would be willing to give a little keynote for sort of to cap off this this ontology summit, which he graciously agreed to. So we'll sort of use this opportunity where Tom can not only give the keynote, but also his Web 2.0 perspective all rolled into one that way.
So thanks again for the opportunity. I feel I've been speaking a bit too much at this workshop, but I'm passionate about this stuff, and it matters to me. So I'm energetic about it, and hopefully I have something to share with you. This talk is really about wrapping. I've lived in both worlds, legitimately, I would say, the ontology world and the social web world, Web 2.0. I'm an entrepreneur. I've started a company that succeeded in this space. I started a company in the enterprise space that used knowledge management and that used these principles and worked. And then I also, of course, did all this academic stuff when I was at Stanford. Now, what's interesting is that aside from losing some hair and stuff, I learned a few things from that, stepping in both cultures that's lucky that we can share. Okay, so next thing. So first what I'm going to say about this is about how do we combine the energy of the web and the internet in general which is the most powerful intellectual force going on in the world right now with what we're doing for a living here. And I just want to say that it all started a long time ago when the internet was very young. Doug Engelbart said that computers and network computers should be used to create collective intelligence. Collective IQ. And he was funded by the government, and he did very explicitly and deliberately. And I know Peter and I both know him well. He's a good guy, and this is the vision that we've been following. Now, he invented the mouse, yes, but he also invented groupware, collaboration. He also ran the number 2 node on the internet. He did a lot of stuff because he saw the connection right away that this internet thing was going to be a great way for us to have collective knowledge. So next step, zip ahead a bit. This fellow, Tim Berners-Lee, whom we all know pretty well, too, had a pretty similar vision. In fact, it wasn't just about sharing physics papers. He actually does believe that it's the combination of people and computers that makes the web the killer infrastructure. And he keeps saying that. In fact, they now have an institute at MIT that he's running called something like Collective Intelligence Institute or something like that. It's the Web Sciences, but it's like Tom Malone's is called Web Intelligence, but they're all doing the same thing. Okay, next. So then this guy, Tim O'Reilly, who's not a scholar or pioneer of the sort of those two guys are, but he's got more web mojo than those other guys do, except for Tim maybe. But, I mean, he's a publisher of all the books and stuff that get about Web 2.0. He's a modern, mover and shaker, if you will. And what does he have to say? He says the most important thing that's happened in Web 2.0, and look at these names he's quoting as examples, is harnessing collective intelligence. So there's something in common going on with these 3 different kinds of people. And I also think I've dedicated my career to that same goal. So let's go to the next slide. So this diagram on the right is kind of a picture, of what the difference between Web 2.0 and 2.0 is. It comes from a blogger, which is a common appropriate place to get such a diagram, because they are very much creating Web 2.0. You see a bunch of little people figures on the right, and not so many on the left. You see a bigger cloud on the right, and not so many on the left. And the most important thing is you see a big red arrow from the users to the cloud of content in the right diagram. And that means it's user participation is the key defining feature of Web 2.0. Several other of them have to do with how that information is harnessed. Now, the facts on the left, you may have seen these before. Actually, the Pew Center has a great study on this. You cannot believe, this is years ago, already a third of adults contributed to the internet, the public internet, not email. And now it's even more. I mean, it's gotten ridiculous. So a large portion of humanity, of people who are fortunate enough to have computers and internet connections, have connected. And that's over 1 billion people. Okay, so this is life today. This is the real world. So guess what? We can really be part of that. Okay, next slide. So what is this picture of? This is a picture of our friend Wikipedia. The world, most rapidly growing source of knowledge in history. And what was that graph you saw just before that giant thing stepped on it? It was the graph of the popularity of the New York Times readership relative to Wikipedia readership. Wikipedia is kind of like the Harry Potter books, but for grown-ups. Like all of a sudden people are reading again. Mm-hmm. And they're really going on the web and using it as a source of information. And not only just a few, but, look at the numbers. That's really phenomenal. It's a real enabling technology or enabling phenomenon. And that's also old now. It's almost a year old. Now, what's What's interesting about Wikipedia, I think that's the killer app for Web 2.0. There's a bunch. I mean, the blogosphere is a fantastic killer app. And I count only mostly the A-list blogs plus all the blogs by tech blogs. Those are really fantastic. Maybe some gadget review blogs. But then there's another subset, which is the FACOsphere, F-A-Q-O-sphere, which is a combination of two things, collaboration and Google. And it just Google wouldn't produce, you know, you type in, my Ethernet thing doesn't work, and I have a left-hand monkey wrench for a car, da-da-da, and the answer is right there. Now, that's not because someone has a support desk for you. It's because some other person asked that question once before in history, and someone else answered in a public forum. And Google picks it up because of the long queries are really good in Google. So there's a system there, a human-computer system working together, right? And that's Wikipedia, too. Believe me, I built collaboration technology that's way more complicated than Wikipedia is, and it had way fewer users. It wasn't complicated to use. It was just complicated on the inside. It had a lot more features, blah, 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 because I was selling to companies and had to charge them. They wanted to pay me a lot of money. I had to give them a lot of features. This does a lot more impact. Because why? Because it actually just gave up on certain things that enterprises insist on. It basically broke the rules. It's sort of the kind of a left-wing socialist thing. It said, you don't need no stinking access control. You don't need no stinking privacy. You know, you don't need a single strong sign-in. Okay? These are all things enterprises have, but they just said later. They think it's better to take what we can get without those things and get the large amount of content then only restrict the world's knowledge to this little bit that has to get through those filters. Again, there's different systems. Like I said, in the enterprise world, we don't just give up those ideas. But, I mean, we have a different effect, a different kind of knowledge growth in an enterprise because of those different filters. Okay, so next slide. So if that's the killer app for Web 2.0, what is the source of the power? What is the source of the knowledge? And the straw man people, folks like Tim O'Reilly, who's a very smart man, but clearly not a technologist. He wouldn't claim to be a scientist or anything. But he says collective intelligence is the thing happening here. Does he just mean the wisdom of clouds? You know, what is there such a thing? If you just took a pile of user-contributed content into a giant database and poked at it, would you get intelligence out? Well, of course not. But there's something going on with the technology that's making harvesting value from that. And I think that's what we're in this room to talk about. Okay, next. So now to get a little bit more concrete, we're in the general space. We're a subclass of technologists, I guess, or something in the field. And somewhere in there, you can see on the left-hand side all the kind of things that technology has been doing to make this web thing happen. And the gray ones are pretty solved, okay? We can capture everything from, you know, your sister at her birthday party all the way down to the giant databases of corpus of everything. You can store everything because disk drives are practically free and the databases are fantastic. You can distribute everything because all the fiber in the world was overbuilt and we just got cheap fiber around the world, cheap connectivity, thanks to the laser and some other things. We've got many-to-many communication nailed because everyone in the world is connected, cell phone or email, one of them way, or instant message or something. That's done, solved, and it'll continue to evolve. But, I mean, there's no longer a bottleneck there. The bottleneck is creating value from the data, okay? Again, the pile of the wisdom of clouds is just a myth. There isn't wisdom in clouds, okay? So this is where the technology really meets the road, and what are the levels of that? Well, the early technology had to solve problems of e-commerce and search, and that's what they did pretty well. And then along came Wikipedia and blogs and all kinds of things like that, where the technology catalyzed human collaboration in a public environment. It made it possible to have no access control, no strong identity, and so on, and still get something useful out. Now, that system is actually on the edge of crumbling because of spam, right? But it was an amazing feat that it could pull that off. I think the next level, and this is what Markov is calling the 3.0, and that company Radar Networks is an ontology company that he's using in that article. I think it's the semantic web, but what's the app? Okay, next slide. I think the killer app is this. Collective knowledge system. So this is a combination of the vision of the web and the internet, of collective knowledge, but doing it as a system, deliberately designed as a synthesis, a man-machine system. And this goes back all the way to Engelbart and those folks, the cybernetician Werner, what's his name? They had the same model. And the guy got the insight by programming artillery guns to shoot down stuff, missiles. And he realized that if you put a human in there that was smart and enabled him with an interface, they could do a lot better job than just trying to automate it. But if they didn't automate some of like the trajectory calculations, then the human could do a terrible job. So this whole cybernetics field came out of this insight that there's a man-machine synthesis. And I think that if we deliberately design systems that way, so that, and these, by the way, the gray ones are, the gray bullets here are definitions of knowledge, collective knowledge system that's true of Web 2.0 systems, which is they get their power from human contributions, they get it from multiple sources, and they get better as they get bigger. They have network effects. Okay? They're stable in an increasing returns way. That's a key property of these things. The ones that aren't just die away. Okay. Now, if you add these bullets in the middle, this is the semantic web piece of it. If you base it on human contributions and you augment that with structured data, then you really get the artillery gun with the artillery person. You get the man-machine synthesis. And if it's when you're integrating from multiple sources, if you don't just mash them up, but actually think about whether the combinations are meaningful, then you actually get the power of synthesis rather than just throwing your darts at the wall and hoping you get a good answer. Okay? The applications of Web 2.0 didn't require the right answer. They just required things like discovery, right? Search. Nobody sues Google if the answer's not there or if it's the wrong answer. Its job is just to give you some entertaining answers. That's it, right? But there are other domains where we need something else. Where we integrate multiple data sources, we need to know what are the bounds of errors and things propagated by combining things with different assumptions built into them. Okay? And the third, we never should forget the property, though, is if we don't build them for humans, then we're just going to have the old thing like if they build it, you know, they'll come and so on, and giant data systems that no one uses. But if we make a system that the more people buy into it, the more valuable it is to everyone, that's the magic key to getting these systems to work. Okay, so next slide. So this is the Tim Berners-Lee semantic web stack. So I sort of come in out, you know, outer, inner on this. But the bigger world is, I think, the web. And inside that, the bigger killer app is, collective knowledge systems. And I think within that, semantic web is a key technology. And within that, ontology is a pretty key enabler for that. Now, many folks in this room already know that. Some know it better than others. But I think I'll go just a little bit into it. The real notion is if you're a conventional web developer or software developer or business manager of IT, you get that there's notions of stacks. So there's this internet at the bottom, and it goes up, programming languages, applications, and so on. This is like that. It's the same. It is literally the same idea, except the technologies do layer differently. And that the bottom layers here are really about the plumbing, about the formats, and so on. And the coupling layer, the interface layer, that allows interoperability at the semantic level is the ontology. That is, it's the way that you can say, in a small amount of space, here's the commitments I'm making about a large space of data. That if you understand this little bit here that I say in a very careful, concentrated way, then any programs you make that are consistent with that understanding will be able to accurately deal with a whole range of data. It's very, very much like a database schema, except it has more semantics. Okay? But because of that, if you get that bit clear, then you can write reasoning engines that can take advantage of that concentrated bit of specification that says exactly what this thing is good for. Okay? And that's what I think ontologies are. So next slide. So now some actual results from our thing this week. Okay, this has been fantastic, and having actually struggled trying to use these dimensions and so on, and listening to Denise talk about how they're not orthogonal and so on, I'm starting to learn some things. And one of them was it reminded me of an old trade-off in engineering, which is basically power versus cost, or value versus cost. And I think we have one of those here. If you look at the space of ontologies, I'll click number one. They differ basically on the cost to develop them versus how much computational, service you can deliver against them. So if you take a terminology or a taxonomy, I know I guess one's a subset of the other, right? So taxonomy is the classification system. I did my homework. Okay, but terminology is like Dublin Core. Okay, but what can you get with that? It's nominal data matching. So you can get a data model that says you either are or are not the author of the book. Right? That's the level of it. Okay? So it's not so hard to make that. It's not free, but it's not free because you have to have a small number of these words. Social cost, political cost, but it's reasonably powerful. It gets you that level of Web 1.0 level of storing everything, retrieving everything. Okay. Next level. Data modeling is a little bit more fancy. We keep not talking about them, but they're the big elephant in the room. And there's a lot of data models. And, of course, the more you put into them, the more you get out. So, for instance, if you put a nice set of constraints into your DDL for a database, it will enforce things for you so you can stop worrying about it. It's a coupling mechanism that basically keeps you from going insane and allows you to manage complexity. Okay? So just think, that's really what ontologies are, too. And we just think a long time about a small amount of stuff, and we can just rely on it. The semantics are, you know, we go back and button and say, well, this one has pedigree all the way to Chris Menzel's brain. As he figures out the semantics of set theory, how does that fly to propositional logic? I don't have to worry about that. I just have to put it in L. That's a technology stack. That makes sense. Okay? The next. Formal ontologies are up there. Now, they have always been the biggest promise for, like, a fancy, whizzy inference, but they're also, you know, unfathomably hard to make unless you have a very specific design objective, right? In other words, they can just go on forever. Psych, for instance. No design objective whatsoever goes on infinitely. That project would never terminate because it has the goal of doing everything, right? But it also has done some wonderful things. It just doesn't have any termination criteria, evaluation criteria. On the other hand, the services that you can imagine, that Doug Lennon can imagine, are infinite, right? So it really is. And here we saw some talks about this, about where if it's an upper ontology designed for data integration for geography or geospatial data, it's still an upper ontology, but they know when they're winning or not. They know when they've covered their space, okay? But so they'll get their – what that does, in fact, is it essentially pushes up on this curve, the value per cost. So that's what you always want to be pulling this up. Now, there's one more that just crept in and click, and that is our friend Folksonomy. So they're the new ones to this game, and they're the cheap trick. They're the low-hanging fruit. And it's been hanging there for a long time. We just never saw it. And it took the web to just say, hey, you know what? There's an awful lot of retired minds out there. Semi-retired minds at night, you know, kids at high school, whatever. It's a metaphor. But, I mean, a lot of spare capacity, computing capacity that can be put to use here. And it really is actually amazing how you can bring this up on the curve. So you take just one relational table of a bunch of assertions, and all of a sudden you can pad clouds and similarity metrics and monitoring and all kinds of cool stuff. And that's with really, really trivial reasoning. Okay? So next. Now, another interesting thing, and too bad Muniz can't see this, because I'm basically saying, I hear what she's saying here, is that if you look at our dimensions, they happen to correlate this way, too, on the two dimensions. That is, formality, structure, expressiveness, and level of granularity all correlate directly with cost, at least in my experience. You know, if mesh is a big honking ontology. It has a lot of time and money put into it because it's got a lot of detail, right? Something like BFO or Psych or something, it's got a lot of expressiveness in the language and fine grain, you know, and formality, and therefore it's going to be expensive to do right. Only certain people can do it, and it'll take a long time. On the other axis, it seems like the dimensions of role of computation seems to sort of be in that same space. If you want serious reasoning, you got to pay the cost. You get more. If you want just retrieval, it's not so much. Right? And search is even weaker. So there's that kind of dimension. And that seems to correlate directly with computational service. And the other one is also intended use. Multi-use ontologies are really hard, just like multi-use software libraries are really hard to design. Usually they're not designed as libraries. Usually they're evolved from applications. And so the same thing here. Starting something that's very narrow in its intended use is less cost. But over time, if you build a few of these, then you can accumulate that cost. Right? Okay, so that's really, I think they're all pretty much aspects of the same dimension. Now, one more thing to look at. Click, see what we got underneath here. Here we go. I just wanted to play some of the ontology. You can just click through them, Leo, because they're obvious at this point. I hope I didn't put one above the other or to the right. I know upper right implies what? That it's a marketing slide. It has a graph that goes like this. That's all. But generally speaking, things like engineering math and BFO have more work and can do more work. Took more work to make and can do more work than something like Delicious. Per unit of content of knowledge. Okay, so next slide. And this hopefully is a new insight, too. That these dimensions also seem to correlate with something else, the nature of the design methodology. So if you look on over here,
The low-cost design methodologies are social. And the middle ones, like what word are we going to use in Dublin Core, are political. And the ones on the right, like how are we going to model our quantities and dimensions, is engineering. Or how we're going to model our whatever, you know, formal stuff. That's engineering, ontology engineering. And that costs more, but you get more for it. The other dimension is this. What's the motivator, really? What's the actual impact of doing the computation? In the case of the low computational services like retrieval, it's just pretty much fun. And if you care a little bit about the results, it's learning. So there's Google, like there's entertainment, like Yahoo RSS feeds or whatever, you know, there's entertainment kind of web, and then there's learning kind of web, and then there's legal web that says there is an answer, and we need to get the right one. So precision and recall happened to matter a lot in that case. So that taught me something, too. That maybe our roles, our spectrum here really speaks to how ontologies are built and how they're used and what value they provide. And that's why there isn't the right answer. It's a trade-off. It's a value-cost trade-off, like almost all engineered things. Okay. So one more layer of this. I'm pushing this one, I know, but this is the last one like this. Okay. What else do we do when we have nodes on a chart? We make it go from the lower left to the upper right. Yeah, got that one done. We work those axes until they're dead. Okay, did that already. The third thing is we got to draw some arrows between our nodes. Okay, so let's put some arrows on. Click one. What happens if you have a feedback loop from the work you do on taxonomies to the work you do in folksonomies? That's called tag suggestion. And people are doing that now. So if you're typing along in a tool and it goes, it sort of says, like every time you type a character, it kind of says, do you mean this? Or would you like to say that? And we actually use that in real travel, and it's great. I mean, it actually helps snap to the grid, we call it, to a set of terminology that are known by some metric to be useful for that domain. We actually made them domain specific. Like, if this is a place name, you do it one way. If it's an attribute of a travel thing, you do something other way. And I don't know, Thomas can speak to it, but I think that this is starting to happen in Delicious and stuff, too, where they're doing some popularity or interestingness metric. Okay. And that will allow us to not just have, if we have that feedback loop going, we can catalyze folksonomies with taxonomies. And then we can form, we have certain long protein chains that will form when you drop this little catalyst in there, as long as you put the right one in. The next arrow is what the Tag Ontology, Tag Commons group is trying to do, which is say, you know, we can actually get some data interoperability leverage if we just formalize our ontologies of tags and get our act together. So if we place this in Menzel's type of ontology, then we'll have to get all the power of all the semantic web tools and so on. In particular, we have this thing that goes from like a low-level tag thing all the way through this thing, GIRDL. Someone mentioned GIRDL, G-R, Debra, which is this translation from like RDF and things like that into XML, which in this case is used for like microformats extraction. So you might have some low-level thing that has that tags in a microformat. And then the GIRDL machinery pulls it up and puts it in RDF. And the RDF goes into OWL and what have you, you know, the whole stack. And now then you may have a Sparkle endpoint somewhere. I'm starting to learn the soup now. And it's amazing how now we can start acting like it's technology. Okay? The next link is one of our favorites, and I think this is the most exciting actual, like, sell the semantic web today, killer apps, is these data interoperability things. I mentioned the geoscience ones earlier, and we've heard some of the medical and also environmental, right? These are domains where the scientists have gotten their act together and said, we need this thing, and we're going to use it. We don't care about whether it's formal or not. We just want to get the job done. And that's, we're going to put some more fuel on that fire, I think, in the next year. And the final flag is this one. Yeah, we can probably learn from those left-wing commie folksonomy people, too. Because it turns out that, as someone said, it was great. Thomas was in the speech, said it was a great idea. You know, there's medical terminology that you use, the docs use, and then there's stuff people use when they talk about how they feel. I mean, you could always augment with corpora data, usage data, and folksonomy is a fantastic source of data for this stuff, for our research. So I think these confluences are going to, in fact, drive the Web 3.0 apps and the Web 2 apps together. We're going to bootstrap our Web 3 apps off the 2.0 apps, and we're going to really have a accelerated semantic web effort because of that. And I think I'm going to close with that slide you saw earlier. One more click. Yeah, which is this one. But I'm going to give it a new meaning. So the last time I was talking about, do we want to play well together in the sandbox, right? But now I'm actually saying, do we want Jackson Pollock
in terms of the technologies, the micro formats, the 15,000 XML, you know, thingies that people have invented? Or do we want to go on the one on the right, which is have not one, not two, but a nice coordinated set that they don't necessarily look like, you know, a pointless painting, but at least they look like art and they give some value. So thanks very much. Yeah.
Sure. Let's have any reactions, questions we can do that.
Yes.
Hi, Catherine Goodyear. You saw a progress toward a Web 3.0. I'd like to propose that another aspect of Web 3.0 would be this notion of attribution. Mm-hmm. In Web 2.0, we had non-attributed content.
Yes.
Pretty much. In Web 3.0, I would like to see us have attributed content. And what I see happening, and I see it happening even with Web 2.0 applications that are put behind firewalls in companies and in governments, mm-hmm. is you get very rich interactions in comparison. Exact same app that you'd have out in the world in a Wikipedia-type format, but now because it's attributed, mm-hmm. the content doesn't degrade.
Yeah.
I think I can agree with that. That's a fantastic point. In fact, as an example of that, this is another a good throwaway example of how semantic web could really work for the Web 2.0, which is if you think about actually trying to get tag data or Wikipedia entries, it could be the same thing, you know, from all these different sources. It won't work with Wikipedia entries. Anyway, tag data or some other kind of thing that has a user identified with it. The thing is, you have a different account in all these different systems, right? And now FOF, or whatever, son of FOF, whatever it turns out to be, there's an identity data problem that people are trying to solve. And if the semantic web people and the web people, and they are working together, get their act together on that, you could have sophisticated reasoning about who you are on the web so that you can do attribution. Another piece of this is interesting. Why do we bother with microformats, which talk about, you know, like which are embedded in HTML? It's not RDF, our no namespace. Well, there's a good reason. For instance, let's say I have a videotape or a song. Okay, and it comes from 15 different publishers, and they have their own thing. But the format we agree to is a micro format for putting a V card, actually they call it an H card of the author as the way of saying the author's name, and using Dublin Core as a way of saying what the metadata of the object is, and so on. Then we have a translator from that into ontologies and from that into the machinery of reasoning so that we can actually say who wrote the song. Is it the same person as that? And you cannot do that with Web 2.0 technologies. You cannot do it with tag string matching. You need to have some interesting reasoning to do that. So good. Thank you for bringing that up. It's a good point.
Any other comments? Peter.
Maybe sticking a fly in the ointment a little bit, but I'm not... Yeah. I don't have any tomatoes today, though. I don't buy a lot of this semantic web machine human interaction stuff. On the basis that, and you use the example of Google, somebody types in a really long query. There's no logic behind that. Someone just happens to have written exactly that chain of characters at the other end. So it's, you know, from an epistemological point of view, it's a human-to-human interaction with the computer happens to be in the middle. There's no computing. There's no magic behind that. But turning it around a bit, and I was thinking a bit about, and Bob was there last week at this Oasis symposium, and there's a guy there who did a presentation talking about the next wave of knowledge management. And he talked about in terms of we've gone from transformational work where we get machines to do the heavy stuff and taking coal out the ground and making steel and stuff. We're just coming to the end of the phase of the sort of transactional work where we've got business processes that automate everything we're doing. But we've yet to move into the next technology wave is really going to be about handling the tacit knowledge, the tacit workers. How do we manage to capture something more than we're doing today? I mean, there's lots of, and I mean, folksonomies do this very well, but what you're doing, it's like a sort of, it's just a sort of process which is capturing something that you're doing manually and doing it a little bit more efficiently, like anything from bookmarks to more sophisticated things. The next wave is only going to happen when the technology and the mindset, I think, changes to realizing that when I save a bookmark, it's not just the URL I want. I want the context. What was I working on at the time? What was the environment I was looking for something about? Who was I on the phone with or on the chat line with at the time? That gives me the full context back. And it's when we move from that mindset of doing just purely transactional processing into that management and shaping of tacit knowledge and tacit working, that's going to be the trigger point as far as I'm concerned. I don't think we're there yet.
I think it's great. And again, I didn't plant him, but that is what my company Introspect did for 7 years. Here's an example of how it works, to combine collaboration technologies with structured technologies. When you do that, when you send that email to the client, it knows you're working on that client. When you interact with that service provider through the firewall, it knows you're on the project with them. It knows what the product you're working on is. It knows what stage this is in. In other words, you can take a structured business process model of what's happening in a business, and you can inherit it down onto the unstructured data that's being generated by the knowledge workers in that business. And once they know that's happening, the feedback loop is they can search on it. So now they can get really highly precise queries of their semi-structured or unstructured content based on accurate descriptions of their business process. And I think you're right. That is going to be the way these things work. You're going to be able to, in the office environment, there was a big ARPA project about that a few years ago. Yeah. Yeah, and search, absolutely. It's context-sensitive search. And it's sensitive, it's task identification. There's a bunch of things that they funded, actually, ARPA, to do this. And SRI came up with some cool ideas about this. Not only what you're doing, but who you're talking to every day. And I think about how spam filtering is going to work. It's going to work. By, like, we're just talking about this in the hall. You know, I get an email from someone, this gentleman here is going to send me an email. I said, please put in an email that you went to this conference. Our systems are going to tell us that in the future. You both went to the conference. This guy's okay. You take his email. Right? And there's no reason just except for execution. That stuff's happening. But I believe you're right. I believe that's going to be a turning point. Because once people get, it's that feedback to the user. Once the user saw Introspect that actually gave them way more search precision and recall than they could ever get from just random keyword search, then they all bought into it. That was the key thing. And even like sales guys who hate computers were starting to buy. And if it works for them, it works for everyone else. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Zhang Junli from Purdue. I have a question regarding the slides of collaborative knowledge systems. So I guess you propose that there will be a deliberately designed ontology layer which can interpret or leverage the people contributions. In that case, my question is, so because there is usually a gap between the language which general population used and the semantics where the people who designed the ontology. So in that case, if you project this system into a web environment, so who are going to maintain that ontology?
Right, that's a really
and how to maintain that?
Yeah, I think I understand the question.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question because it gets to the core of why ontologies in general are not terribly adopted for information organization. They get to force it upstream. You have to really force people, you know, with a whip to just use the controlled vocabulary to tag their stuff according to that thing, whereas taxonomies took off real easy. The proposal of what a collective knowledge system is says that the role of technology is to augment the unstructured, semi-structured data with a backbone of structured data. So one example is I'm proposing right now that we do this thing with geo place names in the world so that when someone writes a wiki page, they get to, in a very easy way, say what they're talking about. Are they talking about a place? And the same thing for time. Are they talking about a time? Just say it. And make it really easy to be accurate about that, because places and times we can be accurate about. We don't have to have a GPS system to do this. And then, from now on, you can do, like, nearby search and all these other good things that are based on that. See, that's the model. If we ask them to say, well, give us the right category for your document when you submit it to the knowledge management system, it usually always fails. Right? You see the difference?
Any questions on the phone while we're people popping on and off there?
Is this one from Cecil Lynch?
My comment on this confluences slide is that there should probably be a third dimension that goes into the page when you start looking at the feedback loop. Specifically, when you look at the formal ontologies providing the semantic interoperability to the data model, because that process is actually quite difficult, because there really isn't a functional ontological services bus, essentially, that allows us to tap into all of these formal ontologies and then feed that back into very well-organized, robust, complex data models. And so I would say that that's probably not as difficult when we look at the feedback to suggesting tags to folksonomies. So has there been any thought about kind of categorizing in that third dimension to start tackling some of those problems more in a essentially a hierarchical way of complexity and providing some of those pieces? Now, I know some of this work has been, you know, it is part of the National Center for Biomedical Ontologies to start looking at some of these frameworks, but I really haven't seen anything come out of that yet. Are there any comments about that?
Well, I'll make a quick comment. I think I like your idea of putting a third dimension. I would think of it as a spiral coming out where actually it's not today's data models that are strongly influenced, it's tomorrow's. So as they evolve, we're going to see, you know, like we used to have design for manufacturability was a big push, right? So at design time, you think about the manufacturing maintenance costs. You can now talk about design of data models for design for interoperability. And the ontology and formal ontology thing can be a way of guiding that. You know, is this semantically consistent with this common ontology for our organization, or is it inconsistent? If it is, why? You'll make it. And then there's also mediating technology to bridge it. But pretty much, I think it will just evolve with data models as new ones are created. That's today. But you know, someone has to be doing the engineering, software engineering methodology for design for interoperability. It's a tough problem.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it from the perspective of complex medical data models that exist today, like the HL7 version 3 standard. And really what you would want, I would think, is some way to provide inference across multiple formal ontologies to provide some semantic interoperability to very highly structured data models like that one at multiple levels. And it gets very complex. And you know, we're working on some of these things at the Centers for Disease Control now, and it is not as simple as the slide looks, I guess is what I'm saying.
I would talk to Deborah McGinnis, because we were talking about, she's got a lot of this in her head about the various pieces of research going on. I just know of a few I've heard lately, right? Is that fair enough to give them your name? Because there are those spots of research where professors have come up with these like query dispatchers or data integration thingies that can reason about the data models and look for the assumptions and how they differ.
I know that some of you, I'm sure, have planes to catch or places to go, but I did want to just take a moment to, certainly on behalf of NIST, give you my tremendous appreciation for the time you all spent here. I think we have really done something, which is nice. It's always satisfying. I think I speak for Peter as well on behalf of the Ontolog Forum, that I found this just very intellectually stimulating and I think satisfying. Of course, we didn't solve the world, but I think we have made a contribution which will last. It will certainly last online, thanks to the Ontolog Forum. And so for that, I'm personally very grateful. I just really enjoyed this. And again, I really respect the time and energy and the perspectives that you all brought to this. So with that, I know that for those of you who are sticking around, the bar opens in 2.5 hours at the Holiday Inn, and I'll be there. For those of you who are taking off, I wish you the best, and I'm hoping that we can all stay in good touch. And this is just another step in our ongoing dialogues and discussions. So thank you very much again, and hope to see you all real soon. Thank you.
And I'd like to express thanks to you, Steve, for hosting this.